are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It's Thursday, January 10th, 2019. My name is Michael Brooks on the first Michael Thursday, and this is the of the year. And this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Stephen A. Cook, senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, co-host of the great Amen Corner podcast. We're talking about the Erdogan-Bolton beef, Trump's pullout, future of Kurdish autonomous zones and Kurdish rights, as well as why General Sisi is worse than Mubarak in Egypt, as we continue the global authoritarian mapping and authoritarian and incompetence mapping. Donald Trump stormed out of a meeting with Chuck and Nancy, said it was a total waste of time. He's heading to Texas to make his case for the border wall. Meanwhile, the government shutdown drags on, and it's going to affect those who rely on food stamps soon, and also routine food inspections have been halted by the government shutdown. It's okay, you know, competition would start kicking in. Pompeo seeks to reassure our allies despite a U.S. exit as he continues to support authoritarianism's return in Latin America. Trump's team definitely had some very heavy Russia flirting. We don't know how high the contact went, but apparently now it's been established there have been over 100 contacts with Russian-linked officials by the Trump campaign. L.A. teachers are going to wait to decide whether they should strike, putting it now until the 14th, as they fight against charter schools for a pay raise and more resources against the neoliberal leadership of L.A.'s public schools. Steve Bannon didn't only want to sell fascism, he also wanted to sell jewels, but was rejected.
The vape pens.
Vape pens. Evangelical groups, this is nice, they wanted gays removed from an anti-lynching bill. But we have some plans for them. Erdogan freaks out about Bolton. We'll get to that, as well as continuing to imprison leaders of the Kurdish Social Democratic opposition inside Turkey. Brazilian political prisoner, the most prominent political prisoner in the world today, Lula da Silva, tells his vigil that he won't lose hope if they won't lose hope, as rallies and resistance continues the first week of the fascist Bolsonaro regime backed by the United States, has stripped gay rights, and is moving forward with plans to destroy the Amazon. All that and more on today's Majority Report. Donald Trump had a sort of non-event address to the nation. I think about 8 million people saw it, cleaned up in the ratings, and he didn't say anything. Of course, he lied, he fear-mongered, he tried to work people up into a lather with demagoguery and dishonesty about immigration and undocumented people. But he didn't move forward with some of the more extravagantly crazy plans that we've been hearing he might move forward with.
Still might.
Never know. But this shutdown continues. And again, this shutdown was essentially, in some respects, came out of nowhere. I mean, the Senate unanimously passed a bill to keep government going. Trump was all set to sign it. And then apparently word from people like Rush Limbaugh and Ann Coulter, the other core leaders of the Republican Party, got to Trump about, you know, where's the wall? And so Trump all of a sudden threw a tantrum. And here we've been for about 30 days And of course, it's affected some real people's lives, like government workers, and it will start to seriously, broadly affect people's lives and implicates essential programs like food stamps, which, of course, Republicans are always trying to gut regardless. But, you know, this is a time where obviously Trump is going into overdrive with lies and bloviating. He's really boring when he's scripted, which is one of the reasons that his address, even though it was fun, we live streamed it on TMBS and made fun of it. You can check it out on our YouTube channel, as well as Bernie's response, which was good. But it was boring. Trump is definitely
boring.
It's boring. You're being boring. Trump's particular form of being an asshole is much better off the cuff. Here he is yesterday.
The fact is that if we don't have barriers, walls, call them what you want, but if we don't have very strong barriers where people can not any longer drive right across, they have unbelievable vehicles. They make a lot of money. They have the best vehicles you can buy. They have stronger, bigger, and faster vehicles than our police have, and then ICE has, and then Border Patrol has. So they're pretty good at that. They have areas that they go to. It's like a highway. And we have to close them up. And if we don't close them up, you're all kidding yourself.
Wow, you know what? This is mind-blowing because I might have to issue a mockery retraction here. But that actually was sort of like apathetically steamrolling over the truth there because his heart really wasn't in it. Now, Matt has a theory about this, well, which involves a good piece of pop culture. Matt,
so,
go ahead.
So Ken Klippenstein, everyone knows him at TYT, does a lot of freedom of information.
Yes, great journalist.
He's not the only one in this sort of circle that can do freedom of information stuff. So I was able to find the dossier Stephen Miller prepared for Trump. To help him to help influence his decision in this, and we have a little bit of it here.
All right, so groundbreaking reporting here from Matt Leck from the MR team. Go ahead.
Mil litros de gasolina, lo que pediste.
Mi nombre es Max.
Dijiste que te seguirían unos pocos vehículos. Hemos contado 3 unidades de combate.
¿Qué le vamos a hacer?
So Trump saw this. He was like, oh my God, I had no idea it was so bad. Trump, if they showed this to Trump and told him that this was happening at the border, he would literally be hiding under the Oval Office desk. He'd have such an extreme panic attack.
Can you get General Mattis to come back,
please? Can General Mattis come back, please? I'm sorry I was so rude. I'm sorry that I told him that his daughter looked fat. Please, somebody protect me. Please. Oh my God. There are really those moments where you're just like, this guy. There aren't, how many world leaders are there right now that are, you know, there's plenty that are as, you know, I mean, they're all in the same vein. I mean, I don't know. Bolsonaro's kind of dumb in some ways. But I'm not talking about morality or politics, right? I mean, Erdogan is authoritarian, fascist. He's an enemy, but he's smart. You know, he knows how to operate. How many other, are there other people that are just analogous in terms of really just, and I'm sorry to go donut Twitter here, but I mean, the guy, he really is. He's fucking stupid.
I mean,
so stupid.
You have to look at other Republican presidents. There's W, obviously.
He's not as ridiculous as
Ronald
this.
Reagan may have been influenced by First Encounters, or what is that movie?
Encounters
of
the Third Kind. It's weird. Yeah.
Yeah, no, but he was also influenced by, I think it was The Day the Earth Stood right. Still, which is why all of a sudden he became really great. Arms control.
Yeah, exactly. So but that's still, least, that's dumb.
Yeah, it's super dumb.
It's a dumb reason to be.
It would be
good
dumb, but like it would be cool if Trump watched like Space Jam or something and supported civil rights after it. That would be like the analogy.
No, aliens. There's still aliens there too.
Aliens.
Would it be funny? Steal our talent.
Would it be funny if Trump watched like, I don't know, like some like eco video that Michael Jackson put out in the early 90s. It was like, whoa, we got to do something about deforestation.
Folks,
all of the monkeys in the forest.
Folks, I just saw Coco, and let me tell you, they're good people. I almost cried.
Almost cried. It was bad stuff. I mean, that was what Reagan watched the day the Earth stood still, and he's like, get Mikhail Gorbachev on the phone. That looks super bad, and also, Aries is ascendant, Nancy tells me. So if we don't do something, the whole balance of the cosmos could be put into question. All right, folks. I like to always throw a little bit of content there that I can imagine somebody at like the Council on Foreign Relations being like, "Steve, you're really friends with that horrible leftist." We'll be right back with our friend Stephen A. Cook, the senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, co-host of Amen Corner. We're talking about Turkey and Bolton. Welcome back to the Majority Report. Michael Brooks here. Joining us now is Stephen A. Cook. He's a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's also, like anybody worth their salt, in 2019, a podcaster. And he co-hosts a very good, very funny, very smart podcast with his and also my friend Brad. The podcast is called The Amen Corner. And soon, in addition to, of course, being able to find it in all the places where you can find podcasts, iTunes, Stitcher, and so on, it's going to be hosted on a website I'd not heard of. I understand that it's funded by the Saudi government, Salon.com. Is that true?
Yeah. Salon and the Saudis, they're real time. I was expecting something else when you pulled up the Saudis. Oh, my God. Hilarious. How's it going?
It's going good, man. When does it arrive on Salon, the Amen Corner?
We're gonna do one episode that's on what's called the JCast Network. We'll stay on the JCast Network, and we're still on iTunes and Stitcher and all those places. And then Salon's gonna host it every Sunday. They're very interested in it. They want to give it a broader audience, and they figured if Sunday's kind of a light day for them anyway, but they have traffic and they did and they said they wanted to feature it. So we're pretty excited about that.
It's awesome.
Slowly but surely.
It's another really great. I really enjoy it. Well, how would you? I said last time it's Zabar's meets Public Enemy, but how would you? How would you summarize it?
I think it's a pretty good one. You know, it really comes out of two guys in their late 40s having a scream fest about everything from national politics, international affairs, Van Halen, the New York Yankees, what it's like to be, a father. Like, how is it that I'm responsible for the lives of two people? I'm barely responsible for myself. And Brad Rothschild, my podcast host, who's a documentary filmmaker in New York, we have this ongoing dialogue about all of these things. And believe it or not, you know, we people actually seem to care about what we have to say.
Well, a lot of good podcasts on some level, I think, are driven by actual friendships among the hosts.
Right.
And, right. And so you guys have that going. And then it's, I mean, it goes a lot of places. But even like as an example, I mean, actually, in some ways, we might be closer on Israel as an example than someone might think. But it's just a it's just this very specific, like, even that's such an interesting conversation. Like, it's a, first of all, even just like the difference between being in your late 40s versus 70s versus 20s and how you relate to Israel and being like an in-between point, and then also being in New York, and then, you know, Brad's a filmmaker and there's that perspective. You're a policy analyst and a historian. And then there's like your personal relationship to it. And it brings up a lot of, like, I would love to be a guest sometime and just like banter about like the personality of Ehud Olmert or something.
Well,
right?
You know, so we do have to start having some other voices on with us. And Michael Brooks is at the top of the list.
Boom.
And one of the, you know, besides the fact that, you know, we appreciate your perspective on a variety of things, you do excellent impressions. And like, you know, just the impression of Sebastian Gorka. I mean, the fact that he's kind of fallen off the,
oh, we
off
miss
the
him.
Radar screen is so disappointing because he does such a good one.
We need to go do a field trip where we see him, like, you know, give some like 90-year-old some like Palm Beach an anxiety attack or something. Oh. Just like one of his like terrorism seminars for like. It's like when you're done with the gefilte fish, realize that Hezbollah could be here right now.
Listen to this. What's the name of that congressman in the eastern end of Long Island? Zeldin?
I think
Michael
so.
Zeldin?
I think so.
He launched his reelection campaign for this cycle with a very special guest, and his very special guest was Sebastian Gorka. I mean,
that's so,
that is scraping the bottom of the barrel.
Someday I would like to do a show with you about that type of, because there were these like hucksters all over DC.
Yes.
And I actually, could you, we have other stuff to talk about that, but could you give us actually like a couple of minutes? Because it struck me like the other day, you know, the dumbest man on YouTube, Dave Rubin, had this guy on from Australia. I forget his name, but he's almost like, I mean, I don't know his level of fraudulence, but he's like an Australian imam, quote unquote. And at the very least, he doesn't have all of the credentials he says he has. And his whole shtick is he's like, I'm an imam who just is like, you know, yeah, Islam and Muslims are absolutely horrible, but I have like a Middle Eastern accent and the garb on. And Dave Rubin is like, oh, wow, like Hillary Clinton liked ISIS. Oh, wow, right? And and then we're laughing about it and we're like, right, like we laugh, but if Trump gets reelected, this guy will probably be put in charge of like, you know, like roving ambassador for Middle Eastern affairs. So it's a joke, but it's actually kind of, you know, how do these hucksters, like how do these types of people get a foothold in DC?
You know, there's really two ways that it has happened. You know, this hucksterism has been around for a long time on the Middle East. And, you know, going back to the Iranian Revolution, and there was this kind of desperate effort to sort of figure out what was going on there. And because that was, you know, truly a surprise to people. And so that began this kind of industry, this cottage industry of people who purport to know things about the region, but that is just wildly distorted in a way that advances a retrograde political agenda. And so what's happened is two things over the course of, you know, 35 years. A lot of money has been invested in this worldview, and that has provided, and it is people have been promoted. Gorka is someone who is, you know, promoted by people who have money and view the world in this similar kind of way and have a political agenda. And then, of course, you know, the double edge of the democratization of media. So whereas previously these people kind of toiled on the periphery, and there was really no audience for them because you had, you know, for better or worse, you had gatekeepers who understood what was hucksterism versus what wasn't. Then you have the democratization of media, and people could, you know, establish websites and programs and so on and so forth and promote the work, the quote-unquote work, of people like Sebastian Gorka and a variety of others who are deeply influential with this administration. You can trace a lot of what is happening on the Middle East and what's happening on immigration and so on and so forth to people like Sebastian Gorka, Pamela Geller, right. What's that guy, the other Spencer from Little Green Footballs,
right.
What's her name, Gabriel. These are, you know,
Brigitte Gabriel, yeah, who is also, you know, and I should say, I mean, the dummy Dave gave her, but also I think Bill Maher gave her a platform.
Oh, sure. Yeah. But our favorite, Bill Maher.
Right. Okay. So, you know, all right. Okay.
Right. So, Maher is an example of something that's totally mainstream.
Right.
You know, he pulls in lots of ratings, makes a lot of money for, what is it, HBO?
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't think he's gone so far as having someone like Gorka on, but others, yeah.
Right.
So that's where it is. But it's, I mean, we could have a long kind of discussion about the nexus of money, political agendas, and people who pretend that they know about the Middle East.
Right. Great. Well, no, but that's a good little intro primer. Okay, so a couple of weeks ago, Donald Trump announced that we're pulling forces out of Syria. He actually followed up with beginning to pull forces out of Afghanistan, supposedly, which I do think is a very good idea.
Right.
I generally kind of a sort of terrifyingly beyond its obvious date idea. You know, okay, and so, you know, the basic sort of premise of pulling out of Syria obviously makes a lot of sense, and what exactly we were doing in Syria and hoping to achieve never seemed clear to me. Could you kind of, you know, what does that actually entail? We're going to get to the Kurds specifically, but do you see this withdrawal as a sort of impulsive and very just sort of Turkey-centric conversation? Basically, like he's talking with Erdogan, and he kind of has this impulse to do this anyways. And Erdogan maybe is saying, hey, I'll stop putting the Saudis through the ringer for the Khashoggi murder. We know how much you like the Saudis. And what can we do for each other here? Maybe there's an arms deal here. And in exchange, can you just get out, which you've kind of intimated you want to do anyways?
I think it's that is close to what I think actually happened. Look, the president campaigned against open-ended military deployments in the Middle East. He used that as a way to attack the establishment, attack the, you know, the Bushies and the establishment and so on and so forth. And I think that there is an argument to be made that our presence in Syria, once the fight against the Islamic State is winding down or has been won, it requires a reexamination. And the principals within the administration were making arguments about, well, we're there for it because now that the Islamic State is on the verge of defeat, we're going to be there because we need to counter Iran and we need to have leverage with the Russians and so on and so forth. And, you know, the deployment there doesn't actually legally, you can't do those things. Not that that really matters to anybody.
Right.
And add to it the fact that he had these conversations with Erdogan. And he had two conversations in 10 days around this announcement that we were leaving. But he had a previous conversation with Erdogan about a month before, in which the president, and this really speaks to kind of how these kinds of things happen, was unaware that the Turkish government regards the Syrian Kurdish fighting force, known as the YPG, the People's Protection Units. He was unaware that the Turks consider the YPG to be a terrorist organization that is just an extension of this group, the PKK, that has been fighting Turkey since 1984. He had no idea. So then that leads Erdogan to make the argument to the president, well, you're working with this YPG, this terrorist group, to defeat the Islamic State. Well, the Islamic State is done. It's been defeated. You should sever your relationship with them and leave. And that makes sense to Trump in this world in which he knows a little bit about a few things as he along the way, but is not obviously a student, doesn't read, isn't really terribly interested in these issues. So he says, yeah, and my base wants to get out. And I can rely on people to make the case as to why we should get out. And so as a result, we have a tweet on December 19th saying we're getting out of Syria immediately.
So, yeah, and I think, okay, so in some respects, it's less important to sort of relitigate in some ways why we're there. And I think that, you know, U.S. policy starting with Obama in the initial phases of the uprising against Assad that started, you know, in 2011 at this point and was more sort of synchronized with the, you know, the resistance movements across the Middle East that occurred in that time, what people called the Arab Spring, that was rising right up against, you know, essentially, you know, dictators and U.S. supported, you know, autocrats and, right, and so on. And then, you know, and then there's this vicious crackdown by Assad. And but then it gets complicated because, you know, Assad is committing all these atrocities. But a lot of the fighting forces that the Gulf and the CIA end up backing are, right, you know, these extremist, almost like, you know, Salafist Khmer Rouge style groups. And it seems
don't forget the Turks were involved in this as well.
Right. And that's what I want to get you to in a, actually, maybe that's great. Before we get to the Kurds, then that's the other piece of this, right? It's not just that the Kurds are in jeopardy and there's already incredible brutal atrocities that the Turks committed in Afrin in a similar situation. But it's also that, you know, even this supposed concern about ISIS specifically, and again, we can argue about, I don't think it was a compelling reason for the United States to be in Syria, and we certainly have caused plenty of our own problems and killed our own civilians there. That being said, you know, I mean, ISIS is obviously is, at the very least, a, you know, horrific, disgusting, atrocity-producing group. And theoretically, that's actually the one that theoretically everybody there from Jabhat al-Nusra to Assad to Iran to the United right States to the Russians, that everybody, to the Kurds obviously, is saying ISIS is the enemy. ISIS is a problem. We need to protect everybody from their genocidal agenda. Except for probably, if we're being real, to, you know, certainly some patrons in places like the Saudis and the Emirates, but then also the Turks. The Turks have a tremendously shoddy record on this. And the other thing is that in addition to the Kurdish spin, Erdogan is telling Trump, don't worry, we'll keep going on ISIS. But what has Turkey actually done with ISIS?
Right. So here's that's really the rub. And that's really a problem, been a problem in U.S.-Turkey relations, is that, you know, we want to fight ISIS. And when we went to the Turks in 2014 and we said, hey, you don't like ISIS. We don't like ISIS. ISIS is on your doorstep in Syria. Help us out. They said, you know what? ISIS is a problem. And we don't share the ideology of ISIS. But we perceive Kurdish nationalism and the possibility of the emergence of some sort of Kurdish autonomous entity in northeastern Syria to be an existential threat to us. So then when you go to the fall of 2014 and ISIS is besieging this Syrian Kurdish town, Kobani, which is within, you know, you can see it from the Turkish border, Turkish forces, which were lined up on that border, did nothing. And it was shocking that the Turks didn't do this, given the fact that ISIS really is a genuine threat to them, because of their priority being snuffing out Kurdish nationalism in Syria and in Turkey. There was another problem that the Turks confronted, which is that after begging the Obama administration to intervene in Syria and bring down the Assad regime, their answer was, you know, the only way that this situation gets resolved is if the United States marches an army on Damascus. And Obama obviously demurred. The Turks turned a blind eye to extremists using their territory to make jihad on the Syrian regime. And along in Turkey, particularly along its southern border, an extremist network and an infrastructure developed. So the Turks were quite frightened that if they took on ISIS or other extremists directly, that there would be blowback in Turkish cities. And you do see some of that in December of 2015. I think that there were, if I'm remembering correctly, there were four terrorist attacks in Turkey in the course of 4 weeks mm-hmm. in December 2015, or I believe it was 2015. Two which were perpetrated by either the PKK or an offshoot of the PKK. And this is this Turkish-Kurdish terrorist group that has been attacking Turkey. And two were conducted in the name of the Islamic State. And I think the Turks are really worried. They do roll up ISIS networks and cells. But from what I understand, they then kind of look the other way and they release them because they're quite frightened of what might happen in Turkish cities by dint of their own, I think, irresponsible policies when it came to Syria. And they align with ISIS on this question of Kurds.
Yes, and I mean, aligning on the question of Kurds between Turkey and ISIS is basically right. Everywhere.
I didn't mean to make little of it.
No, you didn't at all. But I mean, that means massive repression and ethnic cleansing, across the board. They're synchronized on that. But before then, actually, then there's one other big thing that we need to, I think, actually helps us set the table here. I remember when I studied in Turkey, I remember reading an essay by a very important figure in Turkish foreign policy under Erdogan, Davutoğlu, and it was called No Problems Foreign Policy. And mm-hmm. the argument was that Turkey was, and this is about 2007, is totally uniquely positioned. It can be Islamic and Western. It's East and West, North and South. It can be friends with George Bush or Barack Obama, as well as Ahmadinejad. It can do business in Africa. It can partner with China, and it can reintroduce, you know, the Gulf back into Turkey. Point being, and again, very specifically, whether it's Syria, whether it's the Caucasus, whether it's Armenia, whether it's the Eurozone or Iran, have zero problems. Now, how did that turn into we have problems with everybody? We want the United States to invade Damascus. How did that happen?
Well, you know, one of my Turkish friends who was a member of the Justice and Development Party and is now no longer a member of the Justice and Development Party, when the more liberal elements of the party were purged, he was part of that group that was pushed out. And what he said was, the no problems with its neighbors was, you know, something that Ahmet Davutoğlu, who was the foreign minister and prime minister of Turkey, he was ridiculed for. But from where you sat in Ankara and you envisioned Turkey as being this great power in the region, particularly in the Muslim world, and keep in mind that the party valorizes the Ottoman period. They don't have a conception of how other parts of the Ottoman Empire perceived the exercise of Turkish power in the empire. It looked like a really good policy. And there were aspects of it early on that were, I think, constructive. The Turks held themselves out as problem solvers in the Arab-Israeli arena. The tragedy of what's happening now is that it was the Justice and Development Party that, when it came to power, was intent on and well-placed to resolve what's referred to as the Kurdish problem in Turkey. And yet you've had this turn. And what my friend, who is this former member of the Justice and Development Party, said, the reality of the Middle East smacked us in the face. We didn't really understand the region as well as we thought we did. So, as the uprisings unfolded, the Turks, for all of their bravado about leading the region, misread much of what was going on. And in their own effort to bring down Bashar al-Assad, who Erdogan had once invited to take part in his family vacation, a beach vacation, the Assads and the Erdogans together.
Right.
In their effort to punish Assad for first driving millions of Syrians into Turkish territory, which the Turks saw as being destabilizing, but also the atrocities. I mean, there was a principled feeling of outrage on the part of the Turks when this happened. But their response to it was irresponsible, which was once it was became clear that the United States wasn't going to march an army on Damascus, they were going to enable extremists to wage war against Assad. Then, you know, the whole thing, the whole zero problem thing, the whole strategic position of Turkey really collapsed, beginning just at the zenith, just at that moment in 2011, where everybody in Washington was kind of in the thrall of the idea that Turkey can play this leading role. It's a model for the region. At exactly that moment was when Turkey was embarking on a series of policies that would really collapse its position in the region. And we've gotten to this moment where they have, you know, they're involved militarily in Syria in pretty terrible ways, and they have bad relations with every important country in the Middle East, with the exception of the Qataris and right. some, you know, countries in North Africa. But it's a collapse. Not that these regimes are so great, but it's really been a collapse of Turkey in the region.
Okay, so let me I'm going to do a touch of editorial and then ask a specific question about this. So with the Kurds, look, it's no secret. I'm a big supporter in many ways of the Syrian Kurds. And it seems mm-hmm. to me that there's three obviously, look, I'm on the left. They're doing some very important experiments and some actually really positive things in terms of, you know, democratic experimentation, mm-hmm. and ecological rights, and so on. I would say it's also interesting to me. It's a topic for another day, but in a very different context inside Turkey, you know, the HDP, whose right. leadership have been politically imprisoned by Erdogan in a just gross violation. Jean Bajlan and I have a piece on this in the Jacobin. Mm-hmm. They had actually turned the HDP from a just sort of more narrow a party focused on right. Kurdish rights in Turkey, which is an important issue. By now, they actually, and when they really started gaining traction, they were basically set up kind of really a more analogous to, like, you know, a European social democratic party in a Turkish context.
If you're a liberal in Turkey, you voted for HDP.
100%.
Right.
And they certainly, I mean, the charges of them fomenting violence and so on are you know, almost entirely universally rejected. Right. So there is a point being is that obviously there's a very big context for repression of Kurds, and there is a lot of aspects of Kurdish politics which were incredibly important and admirable in the Middle East, whether you have a leftist perspective or a liberal perspective, or you're concerned about, you know, pluralism or LGBTQ or the environment and so on. From the most radical to the electoral, it is Kurdish forces that are bringing these to the fore. Now, specifically, though, when we talk, and obviously there's no doubt whether or not we call the PKK a terrorist group, it's an mm-hmm. objective reality that the PKK has absolutely killed Turkish civilians. They've absolutely right. engaged in violence, and they absolutely at times have presented a totally, you know, the answer, their claims are justified, and the answer by the Turkish state oftentimes is obviously brutal and repressive.
Right.
But the specific, you know, it's like, there's conditions and context, but then there's certain tactics that we just have to say are unacceptable, and the PKK no doubt is engaged in those tactics, just like, you know, the IRA or so on.
Mm-hmm.
So before we – okay, and I want to get to that more specifically in a second, but I mean, first of all, before – how close – how much do you buy this notion? They're certainly connected, but are the PKK and the Syrian Kurds somewhat different things, and very specifically – even just this notion that, like, the Syrian Kurds, if they can hold on to this territory that they have and carve some autonomy, it would seem to me that between fighting ISIS, making sure that Assad doesn't regroup and take them out, balancing the United States, Russia, and right. Iran, don't they have enough on their plate besides, like, right. this Erdogan fantasy of, like, projecting revolution back in Turkey?
Yeah, but this is kind of a national trauma in Turkey. From the, I want to get to your question, but
yeah, go
for
ahead.
A little
sure,
bit of context,
sure, sure. Please. Yeah,
for you know, Turks who have, you know, the real confronted the reality of PKK violence over the course of many years, added to it, you know, a fair amount of state propaganda about PKK and Kurds. You know, the total obliteration of the idea of Kurds in the Republic, and that, you know, they're really just mountain Turks and they're separatists. And, you know, from there, from if you're Turkish and the YPG is what the Turkish state and the kind of mainstream narrative in Turkey is about, you are terrified of what it means for the YPG to be not only accumulating political power in northeastern Syria, but also territory. And the fact that the United States is perceived as being uniquely helpful in this is the nightmare scenario. It's everything that, you know, Turks have been concerned about since World War I, when great powers sought to divide up Anatolia. So there is something kind of rational if you climb into, you know, a Turkish body and you look at the world from that perspective. Getting back to what you're saying about the Kurds, what is the kind of connection between the PKK and the YPG? Certainly, the political elements of the Kurdish political parties and Kurdish political power, these are things that pre-existed uprisings in Syria and around the region. But when it came to the uprising and the militarization of the uprising in Syria, the PKK did help set up the YPG, the argument being you're going to get rolled over by someone, and the Kurds need to protect themselves. So there is a linkage. There are accusations that I've heard, haven't been independently verified, but I think has become kind of a truth among observers of this, is that you have fighters who are PKK and YPG, and that is, you know, a function of the conflict. But I think you're quite right in pointing out that we refer to the PKK as a terrorist organization. There is a tremendous push on the part of the Turks to lobby the United States to see the YPG that way and to sever our relations with it. There is, the United States has bowed to Turkish pressure and shared information, actionable information on the PKK. But there's also, you know, there is also a discussion in Washington is about the PKK. Is it a terrorist organization in the same kind of way that, you know, ISIS is or you know, Al Qaeda?
Of course not, right?
Of course,
like,
not,
that's,
right?
Right, so, like, that's just an obvious claim to reject, right?
And I think that is what the discussion is about in Washington, is that the Turkish representation of these groups is, they are no different from Al Qaeda. They are no different from ISIS. They are part of this radical extremist worldview that we see in a number of different contexts. And I think people are starting to question it. And I think they were even starting to question it before the military relationship with the YPG. For, you know, many, there's a certain romanticism about Kurds in Washington. Mm-hmm. And then you do see people on the ground, you know, it's sort of foreign to American political thinking and political culture. But you do see YPG and its affiliated party, the PYD, doing some innovative things on the ground.
Very innovative, yeah. Great
so,
things.
And, yes. And so, you know, if you're a military guy, you're out there in the field, these guys are fighting for you, with you. And then they seem to have a political program, and you're confronted with threats from your NATO ally, the Turks, and you're confronted with threats from Al Qaeda, from ISIS. You know, the Kurds actually look pretty good in that context.
I think there's no, I mean, that's the thing. It's like, if you look at all of the big context of everybody's involved in Syria, from, you know, the Gulf to their proxies, the Pentagon and the CIA support. I mean, we have reports of at times groups that are funded by the Pentagon and the CIA fighting each other.
right?
I mean, the Turks, the Russians, Assad.
This whole vetting thing was a total fantasy.
Right.
Exactly.
And then
right.
We have one group who, you know, is defeating ISIS, delivering rights, and actually is a completely updated politics. And of course, but even I have to say, even where there's documented failings and abuses by the Kurds, and I'm not trying, maybe it's the soft bigotry of low expectations, but I have to say, it's like, okay, they had people leave a village before there was fighting. very disruptive, potentially very abusive. Now, every single other group we're talking about here, from the air forces of Russia and the United States that are killing plenty of civilians to, you know, obviously groups like ISIS, I mean, they're, you know, they'll right. wipe out a village and they're not have right. people move. They'll kill everybody. And, you know, so just the so it's very obvious who one would support here. And this is where, you know, to me, it is an interesting synergy because I have, you know, I think there's some of us who have a left internationalist perspective and we really would, you know, would like to see and need to see far less military intervention in general for a variety of right. reasons. But I don't want to pull out some observers and some forces there backing these fighters for a variety of reasons. And then I also think, you know, it's not usually my view of the world, but I totally, it seems very valid why a military person would say, what a precedent to set. That you just, you know, we fight with these guys, everybody's blood and sweat is in this, and then we just sell them out to be rolled over at the earliest signs of any kind of deal. That doesn't work in terms of, I mean, any kind of credibility. I know that word gets thrown around by people who, you know, are very hawkish, but right. and some people get triggered by even using that word at all. But I'm sorry, in terms of reality, their credibility is a thing in statecraft, even for good things like diplomatic agreements. And just, you know, bailing is, I mean, it's trash. It's not good for credibility either, in my view.
I think to kind of wrap this whole thing around, there's no one in this conflict. I mean, this is a deadly, horrific conflict who has, you know, conducted themselves in a way that is admirable. But the Kurds, the difference is here is that the Kurds have genuinely been protecting themselves from these other forces.
Right.
And we, I think we certainly have a responsibility because they, you know, they're essentially doing a lot of our bidding. You know, you have YPG fighters. Yeah, certainly they're afraid of ISIS, but they could have cut deals with the Assad regime and the Russians with whom they have. But essentially, they are there so American soldiers don't have to do this kind of thing. And I think you're absolutely right that there's a responsibility to our allies, and it really does damage our credibility. And I think, you know, take it one step further. The announcement that we are leaving and the subsequent chaos that it has produced, not just in the chaos, and, you know, everybody woke up in the Pentagon that morning and was like, we're leaving? What? And it throws the whole thing. But the chaos of the president saying, well, we're leaving, but we're not leaving, and contradicting himself, and then getting on the phone with Erdogan and promising certain things. All of this does is it sends a message to actors in the region that the United States is leaving the region, and we can do whatever it is that we want because there's no one there. Now that sounds like I can anticipate the critique from the left.
Right.
It's like, well, we shouldn't be there. But right. Right. What it does is it gives license to all of these bad actors. Look, the perception was in Saudi Arabia that the United States was leaving the region and leaving them high and dry. And what did the Saudis do? They rewrote their defense doctrine. And as soon as they were done rewriting their defense doctrine, they started bombing Yemen. So there are consequences to these things that I think you can demonstrate a certain amount of leadership and credibility in the region without leaving people with the impression that they're on their own and
What is that beeping? What's that beeping in the background?
I'm in this hotel, and there's beeping that's going on and off. I'm not quite sure.
A fire, please leave.
It's going on and off. I don't think it's a fire alarm.
All right, good. I really do not want you to have to jump out of a window.
I'm not that important, so I'm on a low floor. So I'm fairly confident. If I have to go out the window, I'll be all right.
Okay, cool. all right, then let's proceed. I would just say in general, I mean, as somebody who absolutely supports a project of a very big U.S. wind down across the board. And maybe, yeah, I guess we'll finish this up in a minute because that button is very, that beeping is quite annoying. But
is it busting up your broadcast here?
Well, we're trying to figure out how to do it. But I just think, like, you know, some of these things, some of them you could just say full stop. Stop interfering in a sovereign country in Latin America because you don't like the government. You know, stop
right.
Like, these things are really obvious, but there's other places where, you know, in like the Korean Peninsula as an example, or how you deal with Taiwan. Some of these things are going to require a really calibrated, smart wind down and restructuring. So you don't just leave people in the lurch,
right?
Because this isn't just a one-dimensional thing. Like, sometimes, like in this case, the United States' soft, light presence, that is what's blocking a much more, you know, in that context, vicious and a cruel imperialism that will come like immediately from Turkey.
Right.
Just, you know, so, and maybe in another context, frankly, it's, you know, a Chinese presence that's stopping the U.S. from doing that role. And in which case I would support the Chinese presence, frankly, but you got to think a little bit more, you know, subtly than that.
Exactly. And I think that's the issue that folks like myself who, you know, look at the world and say our, you know, open-ended interventions in a variety of places have not done us or anybody very good. But there are contexts where this is just upping and leaving for, you know, presidential whim or whatever. It is deeply irresponsible. And as you point out, there is a real concern that the up and leaving of American forces in the way in which the president has proposed, even, you know, his more deliberate one, you see that it's running into problems because they're trying to backfill and say, oh, but we're going to protect the Kurds. And the Turks are like, what are you talking about? What are you talking about? You're going to protect the Kurds. They're terrorists, which just reveals precisely what Turkish intentions are as soon as the last American soldier has left Syrian territory.
Right. So Erdogan's tantrum about Bolton, that shows the cards. The plan is go in there and destroy these people, and a lot of innocent people are going to die. And whether you're, you know, a leftist and you're looking for, you know, a model and an ally, the Kurds are, or even just more broadly, if you're saying, hey, is that really the group that, you know, valiantly fought ISIS? I mean, you really just want to just bail and let them be, you know, wiped out by, you know, this brutality. It's beyond me, frankly.
Yeah. And if we did that, it would be perfectly in keeping with the way in which we've dealt with Kurds over many, many years, giving them up to Saddam in the late 1970s, leaving them high and dry after Operation Desert Storm in 1991. My sense is, though, that the sentiment in Washington with regard to Kurds and that history is turning. Part of it has to do with the fact that the relationship between the United States and Turkey has deteriorated so dramatically. Right. And because of that, and because of the Kurdish decision to be, you know, uniquely helpful in the fight against the Islamic State, is changing the view of things. That, though, is cold comfort because, you know, President Trump seems intent on doing this. When Bolton was contradicting the president in Ankara and President Erdogan was having a hissy fit about it, I was wondering how long it was going to be before Bolton is gone. Now, that's not a brief. I don't have a brief for John Bolton, but it strikes me that the president is intent on getting out of Syria.
It was one of those moments when, and it's so, I mean, yeah, it's so, this is kind of mind blowing because, you know, John Bolton's one of the great, just awful villains of our time in every way, shape, and form. But what was funny,
the mustache to boot.
Oh yeah. Just, I mean, everything that can be wrong with somebody is wrong with him. But what was funny was like, I saw another, and, but I had to restrain myself from one of those moments. Ken Klippenstein, who we mentioned earlier, tweeted out a story and said it's hard not to like Trump for this. And the story was basically like Bolton and Trump are so distant and Trump can barely remember Bolton's name. And I just love the idea of just Trump just totally. I mean, there's something. Trump's only public value in life is emasculating evil Republicans. And he's just amazing at it. And it's very funny. Let's do 5 minutes if you can. Can you do 5 minutes on Egypt?
I can do 5 hours on Egypt.
Okay, great. Okay, you have a few more minutes.
But we don't have that kind
well,
of time.
I know. I don't want to keep you.
So.
Okay, so what is going on? Just remind us. I mean, Morsi was deposed by Sisi in a coup. General yep. Sisi has, you know, there's been positive signals for him from Donald Trump, from a freelancing Tony Blair, from a freelancing Tulsi Gabbard. But I mean, this guy is a tremendous, vicious, you know, autocrat. I guess I'm sure that the Israelis feel more comfortable with him being in power. But you're saying that. No, this isn't a return to Mubarak. This is worse than Mubarak. Why?
Yeah, well, I could kind of give you statistics about Sisi's Egypt that would suggest just at a kind of base level how bad things have gotten for people. And of course, supporters of Sisi will say, whoa, he's so brave. He's implementing all of these political reforms. But I look at it in somewhat, not political reforms, I meant economic reforms. But I think the difference between Mubarak and Sisi is Mubarak, for all of his faults and problems, understood something I think very, very important about Egypt. Egypt is in many ways ungovernable. And so that for Mubarak, it was a problem to be managed. Sisi, in the kind of bravado of a guy who undertook this coup, led this coup, and then, you know, the state apparatus kind of coalesced around him, and there was this idea that Sisi was the savior of the country, and that now there was going to be a new day, looks at Egypt's multi-layered myriad problems, and through sheer force of will, and it's very important, and the sheer force of will means force, can solve Egypt's problems. So going back to this question of economic reform, the Egyptians get a lot of credit from the IMF for undertaking these kind of neoliberal economic reforms, removing subsidies. But the only way that you can do that in Egypt's context is through the application of tremendous amount of force.
Right.
So your average Egyptians are suffering massively as a result. Anybody who would speak up, I'm not just talking about the Muslim Brotherhood, but anybody who would speak up and articulate the difference between what Sisi was saying about life in Egypt and how life in Egypt is going to be as a result of these reforms and what objective reality is or objective reality is likely to be, it confronts the very, very significant power of the Egyptian state. Egyptian state can't do much other than apply force on its own population, and that is something it does efficiently and ruthlessly.
So what, and that's so right. And that seemed to me like if you took the three pillars of what took down Mubarak, right? And I like that because to me, and of course to me, there's obviously the world over, authoritarianism and neoliberalism go hand in hand mm-hmm. quite easily.
Right. Right.
And that was definitely a major part of the failing of Mubarak. So people, and it's interesting because, the coverage here obviously focused, if you were sort of trying to cast aspersions on it, it was all that, this is just a Muslim Brotherhood movement. But then people who were supportive were excited by, the youth and the social media, especially, back in the time when people idealized Silicon Valley. Things have changed a little bit now. right. And then but also, what was paid less attention to, but I know people like you pointed out, was, in Alexandria, the factory workers are walking out and going on strike. And the big context for this, as it is in so many places, including in those original uprisings, was like, yes, people are sick of this very ruthless state repression, but they're also tired of like high Gini coefficients and huge inequality and stagnation because of all these policies that work very well and, satisfying the IMF and Western investors, but also just concentrating wealth in the same you know, autocrat's hands. So what does that mean? I mean, I get that he's unbelievably, you know, effective at repression, but it also seems to me that, you know, if you really have a system where basically you just keep doing what the IMF wants, you're going to have a hell of a lot of pissed off people that aren't necessarily religious. They aren't necessarily young and educated. They're just tired of being beaten down. And it seems to me if you don't have enough resources to buy off those people's loyalty and there isn't a compelling counter threat to point them to, as maybe there is in Syria, what do you do? It might collapse at some point again, right?
I think that that is what you've just said. It encapsulates the view of many who are looking at Egypt and saying it's really only a matter of time before you have yet another explosion of popular anger at the leader. But it may be even bigger this time because it's, you know, broadly society is suffering. My own view is, first, you know, these uprisings, they're beyond prediction. You have no idea why a fruit and vegetable vendor in South Central Tunisia, why his suicide kicked off, you know, an uprising in Tunisia that then spread throughout the region. But obviously there are problems and contradictions in Egypt that would lend itself to. What I wonder about, however, is, one, the massive amount of repression that has been used in Egypt has actually succeeded in frightening a lot of people. So you have, you know, the Thawad, the revolutionaries who they're hunkering down. If they haven't been arrested, they're hunkering down waiting for the opportunity, but they feel that it's too dangerous now to demonstrate or to be politically active. Then you have liberals, genuine liberals, a small handful of them, who worry about another uprising because they feel as if each time something like this happens, whether it was January 25th or the coup against Morsi, which many liberals, you know, despite themselves, saw as a way of saving themselves from the authoritarianism of the Brotherhood, they fear that every time there's an uprising, the country becomes less liberal. And so they don't want to risk yet again, like, what would come next? I mean, you know, full-on fascism or something. That's the way they articulate it. And then you have, you know, it's not like anybody loves Sisi, but there is a kind of agreement among those who really wield power, the presidency. Sisi's in the presidency. So the centers of power in Egypt, the military, general intelligence, the judiciary, that this is better than the aberration of post-Mubarak period up through the coup. So they don't want – so resetting the political system in which the military has their delegate at the presidency and that the system that came into being in the 1950s is essentially reflected in the politics of Egypt, that's better. That is the natural order of things. And if they were to defect from Sisi, even as problematic as he is, there's the fear – that this system, for better or worse, but for these people, it's better, would collapse. That's the problem. Those are things that are mitigating against an uprising. But of course, as I said, they're totally unpredictable.
And just final, you know, 30 seconds on this. Again, I'm obviously, we're not Muslim brother. I mean, you know, look, it's right wing religious politics. That's not my bag. But it seems to me that you know, the repression of them has been unbelievably vicious. And what I wonder is probably there probably was some portion of the Brotherhood that really was like, we essentially want to be like, you know, Muslim Christian Democrats. We don't want to cancel elections. We do want some basic rights, but we want to, you know, be a socially conservative religious democratic party. Again, never anything I would vote for, but fair enough. It's certainly something that represents a perspective in the Middle East as it does elsewhere in the world, right? And then I'm sure there were also definitely people in the Muslim Brotherhood, and this doesn't justify the coup at all, who, you know, in the same way people on the alt-right in the United States or in the same way that, you know, plenty of other far-right actors are willing to use the tools of democracy but then basically cancel democracy once they have power, You know, they were inauthentic. And so what I wonder is, where do those two splits go as the group is cracked down on after the coup? And do some of the ones who are already thinking these democratic terms, do they, you know, move towards some type of potential future coalition of a politics that, you know, hopefully maybe in the future we haven't even seen before in Egypt? And then on the other hand, does the fake, not real terrorism problem, basically, that Sisi goes on about, turn into like an actual terrorism problem as people go, well, you know what? If you're going to give us the death penalty for, you know, having a certain type of belief system, then maybe we ought to go and look at an Al-Qaeda or an ISIS model and get to it.
So the latter, there's evidence that the latter is already happening.
Okay.
That people have said with each encounter, repressive encounter of the state, there's no hope of the redress of my grievances through any kind of institutions that are fair. So my only recourse is through violence. That's the repression radicalization dynamic. And then as far as the politics of it goes, the Brotherhood really is in disarray. It's leaderless. It's in disarray. There's still support for it, obviously. I mean, this is an organization that has, you know, real grassroots support. But there's no, and it's quite hierarchical. There's no group within has emerged to articulate a coherent vision for the organization going forward. Part of that is fear, and part of it is the fact that the organization has been been subject to so much repression, there really isn't an opportunity for it. On the outside, in Istanbul, in Doha, in London, there are discussions, there are internal debates, but it hasn't manifested itself in anything that's really innovative. It really is a recitation of the same principles that you had in 2011, which either have no credibility with people who have moved on or are subject to a kind of international campaign to criminalize these views.
Stephen A. Cook, brilliant, as always, yeah. Senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Most importantly, I think a lot of people would argue, co-host of the Amen Corner, which is about to be launched.
Two people would argue
that. Yes, two people would argue that. You can't even get your wife on board with that?
No. She thinks we're ridiculous.
Oh, okay.
She listens, but she thinks we're ridiculous.
Sounds about right.
My wife.
Co-host of Amen Corner, soon to be on Salon.com, and of course the author of many important books on Turkey, on Egypt, on the broader Middle East, and frankly a great guy, and everybody says so. Steve, thanks so much.
Hey, it's my pleasure, Michael. You take it easy.
Take care, man.
Speak soon. Bye.
All right, folks. I really like those conversations. I guess at some level, I'm definitely still just a IR nerd. Those are definitely my favorite classes undergrad. That and Problem of Evil. That was a dope philosophy class. Problem of Evil and the IR classes.
I still remember my 18th century philosophy class where we did Hegel and then Marx and then Nietzsche.
That sounds like a good class.
And I hadn't read any of those guys. And obviously Marx was my favorite of those. And it was very strange because...
Heavy hitter.
Yeah.
Marx. What was strange?
Well, it was a very different time. Like, it seemed... it was presented as sort of dead ideas.
Right.
And like...
Right.
We were still in like the sort of... And this is like 2000... This is around the recession. When I went into college, but we still hadn't like turned the corner that I think we've definitely turned since
then.
That's
interesting because even during the recession. I remember I read Marx in college. I took a class with Professor Bill Corlett, who was a great professor at Bates, and it was called Reading Marx and Marxism. And the first half of the class was Capital, and that was brutal but important. And then maybe that was might have even like the first two thirds, and then it was like a survey after that. And, you know, we read Lukács and Emma Goldman and Gramsci and David Harvey, and it was really weird because this was a couple years before the recession, and it was like it was, and Corlett's a Marxist, but it was like, oh, these are definitely not dead ideas. Actually, you can apply all of this stuff to seeing even like the enclosure of digital commons with Silicon Valley. This is very alive. But then it was like, okay, but I don't know, get Obama elected president. Like there was still, there was, it was like, it's alive, but it's just the gulf between that and anything that's happening in the world was just like just a chasm.
Yeah. Also, I meant 19th century philosophy.
Oh, what did you say?
I said 18th.
Oh, we all make mistakes. All right.
Such an idiot.
Such an idiot, Matt. 19th century, what the hell? What is this?
Well, we want to do our plugs.
Oh, we do. Well, we want to do our plugs, but I think actually we'll do this story really quick to set up our plugs. So Tom Steyer, who is, I think he's a billionaire. Hedge fund guy, environmentalist. If the Democrats have to have like an oligarch who doesn't like Trump in the primary, I would definitely pick Steyer over Bloomberg. Bloomberg is awful, absolute menace. And Steyer just seems to me like I would dig more into his record. And I think I'm sure the way he made money has just fundamental problems with it that have nothing to do with who he is as a person, but just the industry. And obviously, as Matt says, I think quoting somebody else, but I know the quote through you, that every billionaire is a policy failure.
Oh, that's a new AOC staffer. I can't remember his name because that's the name he has as his username. So.
Well, correct sentiment, AOC staffer. Every billionaire is a policy failure. So with that being stipulated, Tom Steyer, if he ran for president, I don't think it would go anywhere. I think it would make a handful of consultants very rich. But I would prefer a billionaire who seems like a kind of nice California guy who's really into the environment than Mike Bloomberg being like, I'm a proud Democrat. Oh, no, a poor fat person's in my eye line. So Tom Steyer, though, has announced that he's not going to be running for president, but he's going to dump, I think, about $40 million into impeachment efforts in the coming year. Now, look, I have been an impeachment skeptic. I was persuaded by the Rashida Tlaib impeach the motherfucker argument that brought me on the side being in favor of impeaching the motherfucker. But this is, well, again, it will make some consultants rich. It's a massive misallocation of resources. And if I could humbly suggest, Tom, you could put $40 million into structural efforts, whether they be, you could fund tens of thousands of grassroots activists doing incredible work across the states on healthcare, on criminal justice reform, on, in fact, elections, voting rights, the actual mechanics and substance of democracy. And you also need citizens that are prepared to think critically and engage in democracy, which is, of course, the other reason why Tom, dude, why are you not a member of the Majority Report? Why are you not at least a couple hundred dollar a month patron of the Michael Brooks Show? Why have you not joined Literary Hangover at the maximum level? Why have you not joined the Antifada at the maximum level? Actually, basically, he should have a list of, like, I don't know, the top 50 independent left-wing YouTube shows and podcasts, and he should just kick each of us a grand a month, just for starters, in addition to funding organizing efforts on the state level. Imagine if Tom Steyer said, I'm getting a Larry Krasner DA is going to get elected across every district in the country. Now, I don't know if he would do that. Maybe Tom Steyer. I don't really know Tom Steyer's politics, to be honest. I know he's said some pretty good things about the environment, and I know that he supports impeaching Trump. So he could overall have trash politics, which wouldn't be surprising. He's a billionaire.
Keep it simple.
But yeah, keep it simple, Tom. Voting rights, left-wing podcasts, progressive DAs, and then, I don't know, spend a couple million to do insulting ads that will annoy Trump. But
infrastructure. No bumps in the road.
That guy isn't even a billionaire.
Infrastructure. Yeah, no bumps in the road.
It's like a timeshare mogul.
Timeshare. Have people that look like extras and showgirls on CNBC.
Offer them free flights.
Offer them free flights. Keep it simple. Take a picture with Cory Booker. That reminds everybody of how totally lame Cory Booker is. Keep it simple. Become a patron of the Michael Brooks Show today. Go over to the Michael Brooks Show YouTube channel to get our full public shows as well as clips, our live coverage of Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders from just the other night. This weekend, Illicit History with Hugo Chavez, the Bolivarian Revolution with former Hugo Chavez attorney and advisor Ava Gollinger, plus just a whole massive slew of histories, primers, Discord, and theory reading. Patreon.com/TMBS. There's still tickets available to see us February 1st, the Michael Brooks Show live show with Matt Leck, David Griscom, Alona Minkowski, Bhaskar Sunkara, Trevor Beaulieu, and now Mike Racine. It's going to be incredibly funny. It's going to be great. Now, like, sketches are being recorded. Now, like, things are actually happening. We know what the show is going to look like, and you don't want to miss it. Get your show February 1st, Friday at the Bell House. We'll see you there. Matt.
Yeah, Literary Hangover. I've plugged that for a while. I have a new project, though. I have a new Twitter Twitter page I started called The Jerk Encirclement. Now, Jerk Encirclement is one character too long for Twitter names, so take out the last E in Encirclement, so MNT. But my inaugural post, Steve King recently said some really racist things, if you can believe it.
Oh, really? That's
the
shocking.
Representative from Iowa. And so Ben Shapiro, I went through Ben Shapiro's stuff, and this is him in 2017 saying, media accused Representative Steve King of racism. They're lying. Read his actual words. Here's a picture of Steve King and Ben Shapiro. And then this article has been updated because here's what Shapiro wrote on the top of his article. On January 10th, 2019, Representative Steve King reportedly said, white nationalists, white supremacists, Western civilization, how did that language become offensive? In light of those statements, this article gave far too generous interpretation of King's words. As I stated in the article, there were two ways to interpret his statements. His later open embrace of terms white nationalists and white supremacists suggests the first suggests that the first interpretation described below was not as implausible as it seemed at the time. So it's really tough when things like that happen, when you're just trying to, you know, engage in the marketplace of ideas, and these caveat emptor, some of these ideas, it turns out they're like racist. Damn it.
Who knew some of those ideas turned out to be racist?
Oh gosh, learned from mistakes.
Who knew Now, you weren't being racist when you said that Mexicans are subhuman, right? You were just engaging in ideas.
There's two ways to take that, right?
There's two ways to take that, right? I mean, the thing is, it's kind of crazy. People on the left say being subhuman is bad, but I thought they were supposed to be open to all humans. It's another hypocrisy of the left. One of the things that we're doing for the live show is recording meditations in Dave Rubin and Ben Shapiro guided meditations to mock the Sam Harris guided meditations. I think we're going to do a Sam Harris guided meditation too, where it's like, and then you're taken out of context. It's just like devolves into him whining and doing like, it's like, open your imagination.
Thousands of people will say you're racist. You need to put them over to one side. Breathe out.
Breathe out. And I want you to now picture in your mind's eye a nuke going off over Mecca. Remember, this is a thought experiment. You notice yourself getting an erection, don't go with it. Focus on the image. Okay, folks, we will see you. Of course, The Antifada, check it out. That's Jamie's podcast. A lot of good stuff over there. Something recently on the insurgency in the Philippines. And become a member of the Majority Report today, as well as going to justcoffee.coop, fair trade tea, coffee, or chocolate. We'll see you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Are you ready?
Who sent us this?